Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is an X-Tuesday episode, and today I'm going to be talking about a few X-Men books, starting with Age of X-Men Prisoner X number 1. It's written by Vita Ayala. The artist is Herman Peralta. Colors are by Mike Spicer, and letters are by Joe Sabino. So, as we know, this is continuing the Age of X-Men universe, the new shard of the 616 universe that X-Man created at the end of the X-Men Disassembled storyline. And this series is focused on Bishop, who we saw in Age of X-Men Alpha. Say that five times fast. We saw that Bishop and Jean Grey had a romantic interlude, if you will. They were doing something that was forbidden. They were intimate with each other, and apparently in this new world of Age of X-Men, we know that's forbidden. Everyone is supposed to be isolated, but yet a member of the worldwide mutant tribe, a very fascist state that we've been examining. And so Bishop broke the rules, and unlike Jean Grey, who was basically mind-wiped and allowed to integrate back into society, apparently Bishop has done this so many times that he's no longer able to just be mind wiped and put back in society. Apparently there are other things that he must do first. The powers that be feel that there are stronger measures that need to be taken before Bishop can be put back into normal society. So he's basically taken prisoner here. And inside the first page, we're told that a danger room prison complex houses mutants who have disturbed the status quo multiple times and continue to make the same mistakes. They are sentenced to reevaluation, where they will relearn to be a part of a harmonious society. So page opens up, we see row after row of cells, and the caption says, danger room, prison complex, location unknown, and we see that Bishop is being marched down the middle. He's got cuffs on his ankles as well as on his wrist, and we're told that his crimes are possession of illegal weapons. He had firearms in his apartment. Conspiracy to disseminate anti-autonomy misinformation. Not sure what that means exactly. And then what we saw in that issue that I was talking about, the Alpha issue, initiating, and in parentheses, a romantic relationship with another person. So no romance, no personal connection. That sort of thing is not allowed in the X-Man universe. So Forge then shows up. He's the warden of this place, and he kind of serves as our point of view person here and explains to Bishop, and along with Bishop, us, what this prison is supposed to do. He says that all mutants there are fitted with a collar that inhibits their mutant abilities, and once they've proven that they can control themselves and stop breaking the rules and have done their mandated time, they will be released and the collar will be removed. So because they were unable or unwilling to conform out there, right? I mean, there's a fascist word if I've ever heard one. You got to conform, you got to follow the rules. Because of your inability to conform out there, you've lost your freedom to be out there, basically. So Forge goes on to say that it's his job to rehabilitate everybody and they have that's sent there, basically, and they have expectations, and he needs to cooperate so that they can teach Bishop. Bishop needs to learn what it means to be a productive member of society. What Forge is really saying is Bishop needs to forget, right? Because we know he's been having these flashbacks, these visions that we know are just memories of his former life. And as Forge is explaining this to Bishop, they're walking through the prison. We see them in the exercise yard. We see them in the cafeteria, as well as some common areas. And they lead Bishop to his cell, and they say, you will come to learn your place in these things. We hope your stay will be short and productive. And as he's about to walk into his cell, Bishop hears laughter coming from somewhere that apparently only he can hear, because no one else seems to react to the laughter. So on the following page, we see Bishop finding a sentinel, and we realize that it's just a dream as he sits up in his cot. And again, he seems to be having, for whatever reason, memories. He seems to be having these flashbacks to the previous universe. And I don't know why he is someone who has that. Maybe it's the time travel, but it seems like most of the mutants aren't having those type of flashbacks. We've seen a few. We've seen Jean Grey have some. We saw Storm and Magneto have it very briefly in one of the issues when they were about to touch. But for the most part, seems like most people don't seem to remember anything from their past life. So we see Bishop in the cafeteria then, and he goes to get food, stand in line, and there's a woman with blonde hair, has the M tattoo over an eye, who says something about him standing too close. And Bishop's like, do I know you? You know, she looks kind of familiar. And the woman responds, well, you tell me. And then we see Gabby, Honey Badger, kind of push him out of the way. And he says, well, patience is a virtue, kid. And Honey Badger says the guy standing there talking to himself, he's like, I wasn't talking to myself. I was talking to, and as he turns to the woman with the blonde hair, he sees that she's not there. And so he then again hears the laughter that apparently only he can hear. Well, Honey Badger says, you and Lorna, you must know the same invisible people. And Bishop's kind of looking around saying, does no one else hear that laughing? So he grabs his tray, he starts to get food, when Beast, Hank McCoy, shows up and say, hey, I couldn't notice that you just had words with one of mine, is how he puts it. So apparently Honey Badger is under his protection. And Beast, he seems very un-Hank McCoy-like. He's very belligerent. He's very confrontational. Doesn't seem to be of high intelligence. Definitely more muscle, you know, brawn over brain. And Bishop's trying to sort of diffuse the situation, like, sorry, you know, not seeing a problem. And Hank says, you know, you need to learn respect. And again, Bishop's trying to, you know, diffuse the situation. Hey, you know, do you need more food? Or are you, you know, he's offering him a peace offering. And B says, you know what? Now that you mention it, I could use another portion of meat. And it actually looks like he may be talking about taking a bite out of Bishop when Danny Moonstar shows up and takes Beast to size and said, I heard it, Hank, he was innocent, it's not a big deal. And just the fact that Moonstar touched Beast, he gets kind of out of sorts. He said, you know what, I'm going to allow the contact this time, but you need to understand that he needs to keep to himself from now on. And Beast walks off. So yeah, he's definitely the heavy, as it were, in this prison situation. And not sure why he's so angry and belligerent. So Danny is kind of schooling Bishop on the way things are here. You need to learn to keep your head down and, you know, keep to yourself. And Bishop's kind of, you know, disappointed about that. If we saw anything in that first issue, that Alpha issue, was how he feels like they need to reestablish these connections. And clearly there's something going on with the memories. And here's Danny basically telling him to keep to himself, which is what the prison is trying to teach them to do, right? So Bishop clearly knows there's something going on, but he's trying to get his bearings. And later in the yard, he's watching Honey Badger play basketball. And again, he's getting flashbacks. He's remembering times he spent with Gabby in the X-Mansion, times that they fought beside each other, and he notices Polaris, Lorna Dane, sitting there on the bench watching as well. And she's kind of giving him a sidelong glance, but when he looks at her, she looks away. So finally Bishop says, you know what, I've had enough of this. I need to know how I know this girl. So he walks up to her and says, hey, Gabby, can I talk to you for a minute? And he's like, look, I think we got off on the wrong foot. If I scared you or something, you know, I want to apologize. And she's like, scared me? I could kick your ass. And Bishop's like, look, I'm trying to say I'm sorry. I'm trying to get to the bottom of this. I'm having these flashes. They're like memories. And I feel like maybe we knew each other before. And Gabby's like, look, buddy, I would remember somebody as annoying as you. And didn't Hank tell you to leave me alone and not bug me? Maybe you should go take a nap. You know, that really helps when I'm not thinking straight. And Bishop's like, no, that's not what I meant. And Gabby starts walking off. And she says, you know, I won't tell Hank about this, but you need to go away, all right? And she leaves. So as Bishop walks back to the bench to sit down, he sees Lorna still sitting there on the bleachers. And all of a sudden, it pops in his head. He's like, Polaris? Is that, like, how do I know you? And he walks up to her and says, you know, this may sound out there, but do you see other things? Like, do you know me? And Lorna kind of ignores her. And then Danny's there, Danny Moonstar. And she says, you know what? She's having a bad day. Probably should just leave her alone. Why don't you come with me? Bishop's like, oh, okay. And so they walk around the yard. And Danny, again, just she's trying to explain to Bishop kind of the way things work in this prison and how he needs to be careful. It's like you have a lot of questions about the people here and the rules. And she's like, look, the powers that be, they don't really encourage questions or affiliation. You know, we're not supposed to be making connections. We're not supposed to be making friends. It's the same as it is on the outside, right? So you need to understand that even though our powers have been taken away, what makes us special remains. And that's what they don't want. That's what they don't want, the connection. And Bishop's like, well, that just seems wrong. It's like, well, we're in prison, you know? And what's interesting is when you think about that, they're in prison. They are in prison. Bishop's in prison. Danny Moonstar's in prison. Everybody else that we've talked about, Beast, Polaris, Gabby, they are all in prison. And they're trying to teach them, while they're in prison, what they need to do when they're not in this danger room prison. But what they're trying to teach them, what they're trying to instill in them, is that even when they're not physically in this danger room prison, when they're out in the world that X-Men has created, they're still in prison. And that's what I find interesting that Vita Ayala seems to be exploring here. Let's teach you how to, in your mind, be in prison even when you're not in prison. That's fascism, right? That's control. That's a society that isn't free. That even when you're not locked up behind bars, even when you're not locked up in a building somewhere and you have the freedom to walk around and go to work and go home and go to the grocery store, whatever, in your mind, you are still not free. In your mind, you're still locked up. In your mind, you believe you can't have personal connections. You can't have a relationship with your sister or your brother or your mother or your father. Because in your mind, you're still locked up. You're still isolated. That's fascism. That's the world that X-Men has created here. You're not free to think your own thoughts. You're not free to express yourself, either through a romantic relationship or the connection of a friendship with somebody, because in your mind, you're breaking the rules and somebody will out you. Because even when you're not locked up, even when you're not in prison, you're still in prison. So that's what I find interesting. And that's what Bishop is sensing here. He's telling Danny, I see things that are wrong. Remembering things and people that I just met, but yet these memories seem like they go back a long way. And Danny says, yeah, I know what you mean. I feel like I don't belong here too. And Bishop's like, yeah, I haven't been here long, but I don't feel like anybody belongs in here. Like I none of us should be locked up like this. And Danny says, no, that's not what I meant. I don't even know why I'm here. Like, I have memories of being out there, of being in the world and not being in this prison, but they can't be true. They seem all wrong. And we see a couple flashbacks of her remembering things from before the age of X-Man here. And so it seems like maybe she never was out there. Maybe it has to do with her abilities. Maybe it has to do with the way she sees reality. But it seems like Danny Moonstar was never allowed to be in the world of X-Man, this new world that he's created, because her memories are of the world before the age of X-Man. And then all the memories she has from the time the age of X-Men started are in this prison. And so Bishop's like, wait, you too? Because I've been. And then the bell goes off. Yard time is done for the day. And Danny walks off and Bishop's like, well, wait, we need to talk. And Danny's like, nope, we got to be careful. We can only speak when they aren't paying attention. Again, you can't show that you're making a connection with somebody. You can't show that you're building a friendship, right? Building a relationship. Not allowed. Got to keep everybody isolated. And you do kind of wonder if this is because X-Man is afraid of people actually comparing notes, afraid that it'll help jog their memories and that people will realize, hey, this world that we're living in isn't the real world. It isn't the way things are supposed to be. So later on at dinner in the cafeteria, Bishop is attacked from behind by Beast. And Gabby's there saying, sorry, I lied about not telling on you that you talked to me again. And Hank's saying, yeah, I distinctly remember telling you to leave the girl alone. So as Beast is about to attack him, Bishop is flashing back memories of better times where him and Beast were together working in Beast's lab. And Bishop's thinking, we shouldn't be fighting. Like, you know, he's trying to establish that connection with Hank as well. Hank doesn't want to hear it, just starts beating him down. It starts to be a full-on riot. We see some guards show up. They tase Hank, and the facility goes on lockdown because of the violence. And we hear Forge over the loudspeaker telling everybody to use this time to reorient themselves to the environment. Think about what's expected of you, how you can be a better version of yourself. Remember, this is for your own good. And as Bishop lays down in his cot, he hears laughing again, closes his eyes. He sees the Shadow King there, you know, half man, half spider, webs all around saying, step into my parlor. Then he gets a flash of, and this is interesting, he gets a flash of Apocalypse. And Apocalypse is there saying, even without context, your mind still knows to be afraid. How interesting. What's interesting about the picture of Apocalypse is it's Apocalypse as we know him to be, this evil, menacing mutant. And Storm is laying there unconscious on the ground, but in her Age of X-Men uniform. Same thing with Colossus. He's laying there on the ground beneath Apocalypse's feet with his Age of X-Men costume on and, you know, missing part of his arm. So, but we know in the Age of X-Men universe that this isn't even what Apocalypse looks like. So it's interesting. It's almost like Bishop's mind is fusing the two realities together. We don't know why that is. And then he's the final image that he has flashed through his mind is of a Sentinel crushing that blonde woman that he talked to earlier. And she's saying, you don't remember, but the fear still rules you. We're going to have a lot of fun. And the laughter goes across the bottom of those panels. And Bishop, his eyes snap open. And he walks over to the bars of his cell where there's a note laying on the ground. And when he opens it up, it says, the dream is real, the reality false. Get out. And we get the message that it's to be continued. So very interesting what's going on here. The fact that it's called a danger room prison. Don't actually even know how big it is. Are the people that Bishop is interacting with, are they actual real people? Are they holograms? How much of this is a simulation? How much not is not? We don't really know. The whole idea of trying to rehabilitate these prisoners so that even when they're not in prison, they still are in prison. I mean, in a way, you could say all the people that live in the X-Men world, the X-Men reality, all the mutants that live in that reality are really prisoners, prisoners of that reality, prisoners in their own mind. They're not allowed to be free. They're not allowed to make choices like who to spend time with, who to have relationships with, whether to be romantically involved with somebody, you know, being alone. Something as simple as being alone with somebody, just you and that one other person having a conversation in a room where nobody else is. That kind of thing is not allowed. So again, this idea of even when you're not in prison, you're in prison. That is so interesting to me. So I really like the voice and the tone that Vita Ayala is setting here. If there's any nitpick I could give, Bishop seems a little timid, more timid than I'm used to him being. I think even in the face of kind of the unknown, and he's trying to make connections, he's trying to put the answers to these puzzles together, he's a bit more timid than I would like him to be. And I get it, like you're in a foreign place, you have a lot of questions, you're not sure what's going on, you might be unsure of yourself. And I'm not saying that he should be more militant, because I think that's a mistake that writers make with Bishop as well. And they have him fly off the handle, or he's prone to violence, or too quick on the trigger. I don't want him to be that either, but I don't know. I just feel like he wouldn't be quite so timid here. I don't know. We'll see. It'll be interesting to see if that changes throughout the series. I mean, I think, I'm not 100%, but I think this is Vita's first time writing anything with Marvel. They are a very talented writer, and I really enjoy their work. So, and I know they've done other X-Men things since this has come out. So, very curious to see how this plays out. Just to talk about the art for a second, it's by Herman Peralta, as I said. Great line work. I actually had seen Herman's work for the first time in the Maestro comic, which just came out recently, and I really like his work there. Here, it's not quite as clean. It's not quite as polished, but, you know, this came out a little over a year ago, so it's possible he's already improved. But I think that he does a great job with facial expressions. For this issue, I would say that's where the strength of his art lies. I also do like his panel layouts on the page. He doesn't just give us, you know, straight panels. There's a lot of insets. There's a lot of moving the camera around, interesting choices to focus on people's feet, have the camera looking up at people. So he does move the camera around quite a bit. And I think his transitions are pretty good. There are times where it may get a little choppy, but usually that has to do with a flashback when Bishop is remembering something from before, remembering a conversation with somebody, and that's always going to be kind of jarring. I don't know that there's an easy way to do that when you're talking about flashing back to memories from before. So I think the art is solid, and the color work is done very well. It's relatively primary, which is good, I think. There could be a tendency to go darker with the palette when you're doing a book that's set in a prison and it's kind of, you know, dystopian and depressing. But I'm glad that they didn't go that way. Instead, the colors are relatively bright, pretty primary, so you definitely get that superhero feel. So good job by Mike Spicer. The last thing I'll mention about the art is the regular cover is by Patrick Zercher, and it's a really awesome cover. We're looking down from above at Gabby, at Danny Moonstar, Beast, Polaris, and Bishop. They're all kind of standing there, and with the exception of all the girls look forlorn. They look sort of depressed, and Beast and Bishop look a little more angry, so that's interesting that they went that direction. Makes you wonder if that's some foreshadowing or not. But actually, the look on Bishop here feels much more like character-wise, characterization-wise, what we'd expect from Bishop. And that, again, I feel like maybe that's the one little nitpick, the one thing that feels missing. Bishop clearly knows he has a mystery to solve, and he's trying to figure things out, where are these memories coming from? But there's not, I wouldn't say there's not frustration, but there's no anger, there's no edge to him. And I guess that's what, to me, feels like is missing. I'm certainly used to seeing Bishop with somewhat of an edge when you talk about who he is as a character. You know, he's always got a bit of a chip on his shoulder, and he doesn't have that here. So it's going to be interesting to see if Vita Ayala brings that into the series at some point. All right, let me go ahead and move on to the next book I'm going to talk about. It's Domino Hotshots number 1. It's from writer Gail Simone. We have pencils by David Baldione. Colors are by Jim Charlampidis. And the letters are by Clayton Cowles. So this is actually in the back of the book rather than inside the front cover. But it does give us kind of the recap or catch us up with what's been going on with Domino. Gail had been doing a Domino solo series with David Baldione as the artist. And this is kind of the continuation of that. That series was received very well, and this has the same tone. So we're told Domino, Outlaw, Diamondback, Atlas Bear, White Fox, Black Widow. Six highly trained women with unique skills and a habit of getting into tight situations and even tighter get-ups. Always outmanned, but never outgunned. Underestimate them for their looks at your own risk. They take the shots no one will. So the book actually starts off with us seeing some sort of green meteorite land on the coldest climate on Earth, which is this shelf along the Antarctic coastline. And the exposition boxes, the captions here, basically explain to us that it's one of the few places on Earth that has no clear ownership. Right, there's 48 countries that have signed a treaty claiming specific areas of Antarctica, but because so many of them have, and it's not really a place that's hospitable, nobody's gone and settled there, and so it makes for kind of an interesting climate and interesting sort of political climate as well in terms of who owns what. And so this meteorite lands, and we see there are some French scientists that are there, and they're trying to go and claim the meteorite because the closest outpost is actually a military outpost, and they don't want the American military to get there first and claim this meteorite. They want to claim it for France. And so one of the scientists is saying, well, we need to be careful. There's no signs of radiation, but who knows what this meteorite could be. And the other says, no, we need to go grab it. There's no danger. There's no radiation. And then we see on the next page when he's actually touched the meteorite, it's doing something to him. It's changing him. His hand is glowing green and black, and he's yelling, help me, for the love of God, kill me. So clearly something not good is going on when he touches the meteorite. We turn the page. We move to France. We see Domino is there meeting with Black Widow, and apparently she didn't know she was meeting with Black Widow. She kind of sits down there and realizes that, oh my God, you're who you are. And Black Widow's like, Miss Thurman, please. And she's, oh right, spy stuff. Sorry, I'm a big fan of yours. You're the best Avenger. Wait, aren't you supposed to be dead? And Natasha's saying, well, some see me as a superhero, but I'm really more as an operative. And I think that right now it's best for the world to think I am dead, and everybody just forget me, including the Avengers. So throughout the course of their conversation, we learned that what's happened is there were two survivors of the three that went to find this artifact, and the other, where they're not sure what exactly happened to, but they brought the meteor back to their base camp and they somehow smuggled it to Argentina. And after that, the trail goes cold. So three countries are claiming ownership over this meteorite: Russia and South Korea, who say they discovered the meteor, and then the Americans, because as I said before, the American outpost was the closest land to, or closest outpost to where the meteor landed. And Black Widow saying, I'm not sure that anybody should have it. And Domino's, she's trying to pay attention to what Black Widow is saying, but she's like, man, I'm such a fan. It's taking everything in me not to ask for a selfie. But that being said, I can't help but feel like she's holding something back. And Domino's like, okay, so you want to hire like me and my friends to go and find this thing? And Black Widow's like, no, you misunderstand me. What I want is I want to join you. And Nina's like, well, wait, why us? You know, you know the Avengers. You have Tony Stark on speed dial. Why do you want our help? She's saying, well, because I tested you when I shook hands. I tried to use my Widow Bite on you, and it shorted out cold, 30,000 volts. And it's that power that you have, right? That probability gift. It's a chaos element. We need chaos because I think you really underestimate yourself. And we see that Domino's kind of blushing. And from Domino's perspective, here's somebody that she's always looked up to and always idolized. And now that person is actually asking for Domino's help. So Black Widow gets up abruptly and like, we have to go. And Domino's like, well, wait, I was going to order that apple tart thing. But Black Widow apparently has noticed that there's a few men sitting behind them that have been eavesdropping on the conversation, and they look rather suspicious. So Domino actually takes them out pretty quick, and Black Widow says, see, this is what I was talking about. You took those two guys out real quick. You underestimate yourself, but you missed one. And this other person that's there, a female, Black Widow grabs a knife from a nearby table and flings it at this person, but Domino grabs it right before, and she says, no, wait, Natasha, she's with us. This is the White Fox. She came all the way from South Korea to deliver the same message you did. We got to find this meteorite. We got to make sure it doesn't, not that it is secured for this government or that government, but that nobody gets it. It's too dangerous and nobody should have it. And apparently this White Fox person is familiar with Black Widow, because she says, just a smidge ahead of you, as always, eh, Romanoff? And she tosses the knife that she caught in midair after Black Widow threw it at her, and kind of tosses it over her shoulder. And so Domino's is a little bit in heaven here. She's like, wow, these two know each other and they don't actually like each other. How interesting is that? But how interesting is it also that I'm going to be working with these two really cool girls, basically spies and such, if you will, that they look up to. So Natasha apologizes. Well, my mistake, Fox. Happy to be working with you. The last trace of the artifact we had is was in Argentina, so we need to get there in some unobtrusive transport. And Domino says, well, yeah, the thing about that is we're going to be sort of riding in a Wakanda-class cabin, if you don't mind. And she says, fangirling aside, the Widow didn't pick us because we're adorable. She picked us because we're so capable. And I can tell that she's hiding something. And it feels like, you know, the South Korean operative, the Fox, may be hiding something as well. So that's fine. Keep your hand hidden. But we'll see who gets the luck of the draw in the long run. And this Wakandan ship that can stealth itself, that is able to cloak itself and not be seen, comes down. It picks them up, and Domino's kind of assessing, okay, let's look at our assets. So her teammates that she normally works with are there. We see Outlaw, and we get a little caption there telling us she's a super strong cowgirl bounty hunter who's got a whole Texas thing going. We see Diamondback, who is a demolitions expert. We see Atlas Bear, who's an exile Wakandian. She's the one who owns the ship and is flying the ship. And then we have White Fox, who we already mentioned, is a South Korean secret agent. And then Black Widow, former spy, sometime Avenger, all the time badass. So Domino's thinking to herself, I know I can trust Diamondback and Outlaw. We actually saved the world twice. These other three, you know, the Wakandan, Black Widow, White Fox, I don't know, they're all political. They're all veterans of a war that nobody seems to want to admit is no longer cold. You know, Russian, U.S.
relations aren't the best right now, and they all say they just want the artifact safe. But you know, I truly wonder. Everybody says, okay, we don't want it for ourselves. We just want to make sure the world's a safe place. And Domino is telling them, she's like, so we're all agreed, right? We either bury the thing or we burn it. There's no taking it back to our homeland to score loyalty points. Nobody tries to, you know, double cross. We're all on the same page. And Black Widow saying, I no longer have any ties to Russia, so no worry there. And supposedly they're all in agreement. So then Domino once again, okay, this needs to be unanimous, or I'm taking my special brand of cheat code and going home, which is I think a great way for Domino to describe her probability altering power, a cheat code for sure. So she's like, for the record, she wants to hear from everybody. And Diamondback says, there's quite enough madmen with super weapons. Outlaw says, I'm with you. Wouldn't mind getting paid somehow, though. Atlas Bear says, I don't trust these two women. One trained in Russia, the other South Korea. How do I know their loyalties lie with humanity and not with a government? And White Fox says, your civilian name is, let's see, Shunkwa? Is that right? Isn't your father a general? Wasn't your mother Dora Milaje? I think all our credentials are suspect. But again, nobody really trusts in each other, except for the three that have been working together for a long time. And Domino's thinking, well, this is going to be a fun trip. So they arrive in Buenos Aires, and White Fox has arranged transport to meet them. And apparently what they've found out is that there's some kind of rendezvous set up in the middle of a cemetery where they're supposed to meet these two survivors, the two French scientists that were down there studying the climate, and get the meteorite that infected the third. So once they arrive there, they're met by one of the scientists saying, this is the offer. We need asylum, we need safe passage, and we need money, a lot of money. And in return, you will be allowed to study the artifact. There will be no negotiations. And then she turns to this is what she's telling Domino. And then she turns to the rest of the team and she says, what this means, you studying the artifact and having access to it, it means that your country will never know the threat of war again, because no nation would ever dare attack you. It means, you know, peaceful life, your people live in safety and prosperity, and it also means a 300-year jump in tech advancement. And the first country to agree to these conditions basically gets to have heaven on earth. And despite what everybody said before about, yes, I'm in, nobody gets it, we burn it, we bury it, we have Black Widow saying, I'll take it. We have White Fox saying, we'll beat their offer. And we have Atlas Bear saying, Wakanda forever, which apparently means, hey, Wakanda forever, we're in as well. And Domino's thinking, well, so much for everybody's word and their pledge that they weren't going to try to one-up each other or backstab each other. So Domino's like, hold on a second. Do you actually have the artifact? Where is it? Where did it come from? And we see a figure emerge from the shadows saying, it's here, it's in me, and it came from the creator. And we see it's that third scientist, the one that touched the meteor, the one that touched the artifact and became infected. So at that same time, the Argentinian military shows up, the federal police, and they're saying, drop your weapons, get down on your hands and knees, we will open fire. And we see that scientist shed the cloak that he was wearing. We see that infection has spread. It's much more than just half his face and his hand. It's nearly half his body. It's glowing green and black. He's got glowing green eyes as well. And he's saying, you lied to me. You all lied to me. And his fellow French scientist is saying, no, I did not betray you. And Domino, when she gets a good look at him, says, man, the artifact really is inside this guy. And we all seem to know that the warning buzzer has gone off, the starting bell, if you will. Now, all of a sudden, Domino's in charge once again, now that there's going to be a fight. And Black Widow says, it's your call, Domino, say the word. And Domino says, all right, the word is given, gentle ladies. Unleash the cemetery cats of war. And they all start fighting against the scientist who has been infected. And despite their best efforts, despite the fact that these are very powerful women, and they should be able to tear into him and bring him down, he doesn't even notice their attacks. And even Outlaw, when she punches him, she ends up hurting her fist rather than doing any sort of damage. He then fires a energy beam and shoots her halfway across the cemetery. And the rest of the females are just as ineffectual. And then finally, Black Widow gives him both of her Widow Blast at point-blank range, which drives him to his hands and knees, and he's trying to recover. Meanwhile, we see that Diamondback has gone to help Outlaw to her feet, and Outlaw on her hand seems to be infected. We see this band of black and green with the same pattern that we saw on that French scientist. So we wonder if she's been infected. Meanwhile, the rest of them are wondering where on earth this power could have come from that this scientist is exhibiting, the one that's been infected by this artifact. And his response is, where on earth? Well, nowhere. It's not terrestrial at all. Nowhere on earth. This godlike power, it's celestial. So we're talking about the Celestials, the really powerful ancient beings in the Marvel Universe who have nearly godlike power, and apparently it's a piece of one of those Celestials that had fallen to Earth and has infected those infected this scientist, rather. So they're unable to stop him as he floats up and away, apologizes to his colleagues, saying, it's clear to me I can't be a part of your world anymore. Don't try to follow me. I won't be recognizable. And we do even see that the infection has spread, or looks like it's spread even further. And Domino's like, well, now what? Do we call for help? Well, we don't want the Avengers to be infected with that. So I think it's us or it's no one. We go, we track him, and we put that mad dog down. And then there's a voice off panel that says, I'm sorry, Nina. I always really liked you. In fact, I liked all three of you. I liked you and Outlaw and Diamondback, but I got to stop you. I got to stop you good and proper, like with extreme prejudice, but if I kill you extra fancy, can we still be friends? And the voice off panel's from Deadpool. So we get that final page splash where he's sitting on a scooter with a giant gun. Doesn't say why he's got to stop Nina from stopping this person infected with the celestial artifact. I imagine that he's a mercenary. It's Deadpool. He's probably been hired by somebody else to retrieve the artifact, or lacking that, retrieve the scientist himself. So we've got Deadpool at odds with Domino. Domino looking to do the right thing. Definitely much more of a hero than Deadpool. Domino looking to do the right thing, secure the artifact, make sure no one has it. The others, you know, their loyalty, clearly, although they said they were on board with Domino's plan, not really, you know, only in as much as it would gain them access to the artifact, and they wanted to claim it for themselves, for their own country. And now we have Deadpool with his own goals, let's put it that way. And those goals are likely, you know, whatever goals are of the person that hired him. So in terms of this issue, I do have to say I'm not a Deadpool fan at all. I don't find his incessant chatter to be funny or charming. He's just annoying in my mind. I've never really cared for him. I know I'm in the minority. I know there's a lot of people that love him and his jokes. I think he has potential to be a great character, but I think the forced humor aspect of it just puts it over the top for me. I would much rather have him a serious character and examine why he is who he is and what the damage to his body and psyche has done to him. To me, that's a more interesting story than just having him be this supposed humorous character who breaks the fourth wall and all that. So I do have to say I was kind of disappointed to see him show up on the last page here. But, I mean, I'm not abandoning the series yet, because what I do love is I love the way that Gail Simone writes these female characters. I love the way that she wrote Domino and Outlaw and Diamondback in her first Domino series that she did. I think that
She's got a great take on their relationship and what makes them tick and the way they play off each other and interact. And now we've thrown three others into the mix here with Atlas Baron, White Fox, and Black Widow, whose loyalties are questionable. And can they really be trusted? What do they really want? And that sort of thing. So you're throwing them in as well. And we're getting to play off those three characters versus the three characters that we've known for a long time. And I find that to be really interesting and more than enough reason for me to come back and keep reading, despite the fact that we're going to get Deadpool. Plus, I have to admit that I haven't read a lot of the Gail Simone version of Deadpool. And I know that she, along with Joe Kelly, are really the ones who kind of establish him and his personality. So it might not be as bad as I'm expecting, or as bad as I think it might be in respect to Deadpool. I just get tired of him so quickly. But again, I love the setup. I love the premise. It feels very much like kind of the opening, like third, let's say, of a James Bond movie, where you've got this incredibly powerful artifact that their powers that be are worried about it falling into the wrong hands. And so we've got James Bond and his allies trying to go out and secure it. And then all hell kind of breaks loose and, you know, we expect to have a lot of action and intrigue and such follow along. Plus, you've got the whole aspect of who can you trust, even though you're working with them. It doesn't appear that Black Widow, White Fox, or Atlas Bear can be trusted, only up to a point. Like, what happens when they confront the scientist the next time? Like, who is going to actually take the artifact? Are they going to be able to separate it from the scientist? Would they cross that line? Would they kill the scientist if it came down to it, to keep the artifact from falling into the hands of another one of the countries? That's a pretty interesting aspect to the story. And the other thing I find really fascinating is the fact that you're talking about street-level characters here. Diamondback, Outlaw, Deadpool, Domino, you know, despite her, as she calls it, her special brand of cheat code, these are much more street-level characters. They're not the kind of characters that you would necessarily expect to be dealing with something as powerful as a Celestial, right? Even if it's only part of a Celestial, it's clear that this scientist who's been infected with the artifact is vastly powerful. So when you've got that level of power and you're talking about these street-level characters, how do they handle that? What decisions do they make? All that aspect is super interesting as well. Plus the art by David Baldone. I don't know if any of you are familiar with his art, or if you read any of the first Domino series that he and Gail Simone did, but he could be my favorite Domino artist ever. You know, Domino created by Rob Liefeld, and she always felt very angular and very severe. And she just didn't, I don't know, she kind of had this edge to her, made her seem like she was always in a bad mood. You could never get close to her. You could never get her to open up. There's no vulnerability there. She's a very two-dimensional character. You know, just think angry mercenary chick. Just random angry mercenary chick. Gail Simone has softened her up a lot. But without reducing her threat level. You know, she still seems like she's incredibly dangerous, incredibly capable, but she's made her a lot more relatable. She's made her somebody you can root for much easier, because you do see how much she cares about her fellow female partners. And David Baldone, with the line work and the way he draws these characters, really illustrates that, like literally illustrates that. She is a little bit softer in appearance. She is a little more emotive in her expression, and she just seems more real. Like, You know, she does get happy. She does get sad. She does have emotions and feelings, and cares about her partners, Outlaw and Diamondback. And that comes through in the way that he renders them very well. Also, he's great at drawing action. His art is really kinetic, and he zooms in a lot. I think there's a tendency when you have certainly a lot of characters fighting to kind of go really widescreen. That's sort of, I mean, there's talk of it having begun when Brian Hitch did the Ultimates, and there certainly can be an argument made there. That's the first time we started talking about widescreen comics, or, you know, comics having a quote-unquote cinematic feel. Baldone almost goes the other way in his action scenes. He zooms in on what we need to see. You know, even though there's multiple people battling this scientist that's infected with the celestial artifact, we're not seeing everybody at once. Everybody doesn't need to be in the panel. It's enough to see the scientist and Outlaw punching him, or the scientist and blasting Outlaw with his celestial powers. It doesn't always have to be everybody in the panel. And I like that. I like that it's not so widescreen, if you will. It's more zoomed in. It's more impactful. Plus, he does great things with the panel borders to show, to kind of switch it up to show action and energy and things like that. So the art is absolutely spectacular. The color work is also done really, really well by Jim Charlampidis. He keeps it very primary, very bright colors, which kind of suits the personality and the relatability that Gail Simone has brought to Domino and her partners. You know, it's not, this isn't, as much as it feels like a James Bond or kind of a spy sort of narrative, it's not that dark, moody, Cold War story type coloring, you know, where everything is kind of dark and muddy. It's very bright. And so even though these are high stakes, even though the scientist is infected with that celestial artifact, and we're talking about massive power levels here, it still stays fun, and it still stays true to that lighter feel and lighter touch that Gail Simone has brought to Domino, because Charlampidis uses bright colors. He uses, even though it's at night, you know, we're getting bright greens, we're getting the bright pink of Diamondback's hair, we're getting the bright red of Black Widow's hair. And so it would be easy to slip into those dark colors, make the comic more moody, but I think that Charlampidis choosing to use a brighter palette works really well here, because again, it suits the personality and the tone that Gail Simone has given to Domino and her partners, as well as helps keep the comic light, which sort of suits the humor that Simone brings to Domino, and also the humor that's going to come from Deadpool, because you know there's going to be jokes there from Deadpool as well. So definitely recommend Domino Hot Shots. I think it was only a 5-issue limited. So I absolutely love the way that Gail Simone writes Domino. So definitely recommend picking this one up. All right, the last book I'm going to talk about is Uncanny X-Men number 13 from writer Matthew Rosenberg. We have art by Salvador LaRocca, colors by Guru EFX, and letters by Joe Caramagna. So we saw last issue, Cyclops, along with Wolverine, went to ONE and rescued a bunch of mutants from there. And now they've got to figure out, okay, what comes next, right? The fact that they rescued Wolfsbane, Mirage, Karma, Havoc from the Office of National Emergency, the agency that polices mutants, is great. They're successful on their first mission, but now what, right? So this is part three of This Is Forever, and I love that the first thing you see when you open up the cover on the first page is, we're together again, now we need a reason why. So you kind of thought that Cyclops and Wolverine would immediately start searching for the other X-Men. They got to believe they're still alive somewhere out there, just purely based on the fact that they've seen it happen so many times, right? There's been so many times where supposedly the X-Men have been killed, but they always find a way to survive, but they don't even know kind of where to start looking. So you've got to wonder, okay, we've rescued these people, but now what?
So the actual story starts at Harry's Hideaway, Salem Center, and Havoc is saying, I'm so bored, Logan. You want to play? How come we can't go out the front door, but you can? And Wolverine is explaining that, you know, Harry's an old friend, told him we're in a tight spot. He's putting himself at great risk just to keep us, to give us a space and to keep us here. But, you know, we can't be seen. And Havoc's like, well, but you can. Well, yeah, because Wolverine's supposed to be dead and nobody knows that he's alive. And Havoc's like, well, yeah, living in the back of a bar is pretty embarrassing. And Wolverine's like, yeah, I get that. I get that. Like, it is embarrassing. And also, where's that girl with all the eyes and the green skin that we rescued? Well, nobody's sure. Rain, or Wolfsbane, basically says that, yeah, she ran away. Like, when we first got here. So Wolverine is worried about that because, again, there aren't any more mutants, supposedly. You know, most of them disappeared at the end of that X-Men disassembled storyline. And for somebody like that girl with, you know, six red eyes on her face and green skin, she's obviously a mutant, right? She can't hide. You know, it's like Nightcrawler back in the day. It's not easy to hide that level of mutation, so they worry about her. It's not a mutant, anti-mutant sentiment is at a pretty pretty big high right now, and so, you know, he's worried about that. So the rest of them, they're like, well, what are we gonna do though? That's where we really need to be worried about. What, like, where's Cyclops? Somebody says, well, he's upstairs, he's trying to figure out what we're supposed to do. And then Cyclops actually walks in the room and says, no, I'm not. And so they're wondering, okay, what are we gonna do? And Cyclops says, well, I've thought about it. You know, we're still X-Men, so we do what we've always done. Nothing's changed. And Havoc's like, I gotta disagree. Things have changed a lot. The X-Men are gone. They're not coming back. And, you know, he gets some pushback on that because, again, they've been gone before and they've always come back. But Havoc's like, no, but this is different this time. After what Nate and Legion did, the world wants all the mutants to go away. We've got this anti-mutant vaccine, which is preventing any future generation of mutants from existing. The school's gone, so there really is no going back, not like there was in the past. And Cyclops is like, you done? And Havoc's like, well, let me see. All, he's counting these off on his fingers. All our friends are dead. Everyone hates us. There's no future. Yeah, I guess that's it. And so Cyclops goes, great. And he lays down on the pool table this list that he has created, which has a ton of names on there. Dark Beast, Acolytes, Mr. Sinister, Mutant Force, Cassandra Nova, Nasty Boys, Gene Nation, Factor 3, Legion, Vulcan, Proteus, The Marauders, Morlocks, New Mutants, Children of the Vault. And then at the bottom in big letters, find the X-Men, and that one's underlined. And the others come over to the table and they're looking at it and they're saying, well, what is this? And Havoc's like, is it the worst guest list I've ever seen? And Magic's like, well, no, it's a suicide pact. And Wolverine, probably the closest of anybody, says, no, it's a kill list. Cyclops says, no, it's not. We're not solving things that way anymore. So clearly a step back from where Cyclops was right before he died, right? Which we talked about at length. The semi spotlight we did on Cyclops when we talked about the Uncanny X-Men annual. And Wolverine's like, but you know, that's the best way to make sure things stay solved. Well, I see Wolverine's point, but at the same time, in the Marvel Universe, nobody really stays dead. So is it really Wolverine, killing people really the best way? Because they come back anyway. And Cyclops is like, look, we get it. The person with knives for his hands thinks that stabbing everybody is the solution to all the problems, just like always. So we're seeing that back and forth from Cyclops and Wolverine like we always do. And I love Wolverine's response. He says, and it looks like killing people isn't the answer for the guy who's always looking at the world through rose-colored glasses. And Cyclops kind of smiles at that and says, you've been waiting a long time to use that one, haven't you? Wolverine's like, yeah, maybe. I think Matthew Rosenberg has been waiting a long time to use that one. And it's a great line. I've never thought about that. I've never really seen Cyclops as an optimistic person, more of a realist. But he did always have a belief in Xavier's dream, maybe even when he shouldn't have, until the last, you know, few years. And again, we talked about that in the Cyclops spotlight. And it did give me an appreciation, and I talked about this on that episode, did give me appreciation for who Cyclops was before. He always believed in that dream, maybe to a fault, maybe because he was looking through rose-colored glasses, at least metaphorically. So that's interesting. But Cyclops does say, look, this is a list of the biggest problems as I see it, X-Men problems. If we have no future, as Havok is saying, then I want to make sure that the place I leave behind is better for me having been here. So we're going to show the world right now what it meant to be an X-Men. And if this is our legacy, then I think it's a worthy one. And Magic's like, so I was right. It is a suicide pact. And Cyclops is like, I wouldn't call it that, but this is going to be dangerous, right? These are our most difficult foes and our most difficult problems. And if anybody wants out, I get it. No judgment. If these really are the last days of the X-Men, I'm going to die trying to make things right. So are you with me? And everybody, despite what they said, despite their reservations, suicide pact, no reason to live, no future, as Alex put it, they're all in. And everybody says they're in, except for Wolverine. And when they look at him, they're like, what? I'm still an X-Men, aren't I? And Havoc's like, okay, great. Now we decided what we're going to do, but we still have no money. We have no base. We have no plane. We don't even have uniforms. And Wolverine's, you know, about that. I want to see what I could salvage from the tunnels under the school before anybody realizes they're there. And look what I found. And as he opens up a bag full of uniforms, Havoc's like, what year do you think this is? And on the next page, we see them teleporting with Magic's abilities into a warehouse in Long Island City. And they're wearing a lot of the uniforms that look very 90s, the blue and the yellow. Wolverine's got his brown and light, dark brown and light brown costume on, the rest of them very 90s. And as soon as they teleport into this warehouse, they're attacked by these cyborgs. And basically, this warehouse has been a laboratory in recent times for Dark Beast. And he has grafted parts of Jamie Madrox, parts of the Multiple Men, onto these cyborgs. And so as they're attacking them, they first thought they were robots until some of them actually screamed. And Magic's like, did yours just scream? And as they look at him laying there on the ground, they're like, oh my God, it's Jamie Madrox. And then the real Jamie Madrox shows up and he's like, what did you do? And like, well, sorry, we didn't know. And Cyclops goes up and says, Jamie, do you mind telling us what's going on here? And Jamie explains that the Dark Beast had captured some of his duplicates. He's been experimenting on them. He's been doing experiments on me, same as he's doing everyone these days. And Cyclops wants to know, well, where he went. He goes, well, how would I know? I tracked him here to this laboratory the same as you, but this is my last lead. Everything is a dead end after this. And so they asked Jamie to reabsorb what human parts are left of his duplicate. He's like, I he's gonna die. We can't save him. So you're asking me to bond with this duplicate, to bring him back inside me, and he'll die inside me. And you don't have any idea how bad that feels. Cyclops is like, I don't, but what else can I do? And so Jamie, you know, of course, being the hero that he is, self-sacrifice, he does go ahead and pull that dupe back inside him. And as it dies inside of him, he cries out in pain and then comes over to the rest of the X-Men and says, I know where he is. Let's go. And so they track Beast down. He's a Dark Beast. He's in an 18-wheeler being driven by one of the other androids. And Cyclops basically scrags it with his optic blast. And then they get to work on attacking all these other androids that the Beast has guarding him. And the Beast is very powerful. Dark Beast is very powerful. He talks about how he always thought that the next stage in evolution was going to be genetic. He says, we spent all our lives obsessing over genetic evolution. But what I realized when I was killed and Mr. Sinister brought me back, he grafted my head onto this, you know, robotic body, this cyborg body. And that made me realize I had been blind to the truth that technological evolution is the future, because our genes are so hard to predict, right? They mutate, they're hard to control, but technology evolves, and it evolves in a way that is so much easier to control and easier to predict. And so that really is the future. So I'm still a mutant. In fact, I'd say I'm more a mutant than ever before, but now I can control my own mutation because it's a mutation of technology. And then he makes an offer. He says, I'd love to show you the way. I can bring the X-Men back, right? Some of Mr. Madrox's creations or duplicates already volunteered. Well, not exactly volunteered. And meanwhile, again, super powerful dark beast, very good fighter. He's basically able to keep the X-Men at bay until Magic says, you know what? I can get to him. I mean, Cyclops is ready to retreat. It's like he's already taken out a couple of our guys, and we're not getting through. We've got four teammates down. And Magic says, no, I can get to him. And Dark Beast, of course, underestimates her and thinks he's going to be able to stop her sword as she flings it at him. But before it gets to his shield, she concentrates and she creates a portal. So the sword actually disappears before it hits the shield and then reappears on the other side of his shielding and stabs right through him. And he screams out, saying, as he's laying there on the ground, treacherous witch, I'm going to play around in your guts. And she pulls her sword out of him, and Jamie's like, can I see that? And he raises it above his head. He's going to stab Beast. And this is for what you did to me and my, you know, duplicates. You tortured me. And Cyclops, Jamie, no. We have to be better than him. And Jamie's like, I was going to be better than him, because I wasn't going to torture him the way he tortured me. I was just going to kill him. And Dark Beast is like, that's right. You can't kill me because Scott needs me. He needs my big brain. I'm too valuable. And Wolverine is there popping his claws saying, you want to test that theory? You want to see if that's actually true? And Dark Beast is like, no, let's just listen to what Cyclops has to say. So later at the bar, Cyclops is trying to get some sleep when Havoc comes in and says, hey, we have Dark Beast chained up in the basement. Danny and Shan are watching him. And I wanted to talk to you about him because this isn't like old times. We're living in a bar. You know, we don't have a base. Can we really be taking prisoners? You know, we don't have the resources to do these kind of things. And Cyclops is like, we can't just let him go. Havoc's like, I get that. But, you know, the mission today, he took us out in the open. If the world knew we were here. And Cyclops is like, well, that's the point. If people know mutants are hid out there and we're still fighting for them, we're still trying to keep them safe, maybe it'll give them hope. And Havoc's not buying. He's like, maybe it will show them that they need to kill mutants even faster because they still fear us, right? Let's just kill all the mutants to make sure things don't go back the way they were when there were a lot of mutants around. And Cyclops is like, can you really, really think that? And Havoc's like, I don't know, you know? What you made the X-Men at the end, the way you were, I can't let you go back to that. You know, when he's talking about when Cyclops became so militant, when he became so us versus them, and he had become so radicalized. And before they can finish their conversation, Rain steps in the room and says, you might want to see this. And when they head down to the bar on the news, there's a reporter saying, you know, there's been a reappearance of Scott Summers, Cyclops, last week, and that appearance kind of provides evidence that maybe the radical mutant group X-Men has come back. And we have some security footage that was caught at a facility tonight. When they show the footage, it's not actually the X-Men, it's the MLF, the Mutant Liberation Front. And they were attacking a facility that was distributing the anti-mutant vaccine. And when the X-Men see them on the screen, they're like, well, that's the MLF. It's so bad they can't even tell us apart from Mutant Liberation Front, who are terrorists, versus the X-Men, who are heroes. And Wolverine saying, well, the MLF was on our list. It looks like they jumped up a few rungs. It looks like we may need to take care of them right now. And then as they're watching the footage, they see that Hope, Summers, and Banshee were with the MLF when they made their attack. So Alex says, well, brother, you said the world needed Hope. There she is. And I guess that's what we'll see next issue. The X-Men going to track down the MLF, try to rescue Hope, try to rescue Banshee, expand their numbers, and hopefully find where the rest of the X-Men have gone. That is the ultimate goal. So love what Matthew Rosenberg is doing here. You know, the X-Men world before the X-Men disassembled storyline, the X-Men corner of the Marvel Universe had gotten so big and so convoluted, and I love that they took a step back. They took so many of the mutants off the board and by telling the story that they told in X-Men Disassembled. And now we've got Cyclops and Wolverine and the rest of the mutants that they have rescued and recruited really acting as sort of a guerrilla squad. It harkens back so much to the early days of the X-Men, where there weren't thousands of mutants out there. It wasn't this giant world and giant mythos of mutants with everything interconnected and everything so complicated. I know Matthew Rosenberg has been a fan of the X-Men for ever, you know, probably for his whole comic book reading life. And so it's really a way for him to tap back into those smaller stories, more intimate stories, where it's about the self-sacrifice of the mutants. It's about the relationship of the mutants. So I really enjoy that about the story. I would say that this isn't a really, it's in a way, it's a fast-paced issue, but in a way it's not, because there's not a lot of action. You basically get the fight with Dark Beast and that's sort of it. The rest is a lot of setup, but it shows so much who these characters are and who they are in terms of the situation they're put in and what is their reaction. So that is very classic X-Men as well. I think Matthew Rosenberg is doing an absolutely superb job of this. It makes me kind of wish that the reboot and the Jonathan Hickman X-Men world hadn't happened, because I want to read this. I want to read Matthew Rosenberg's take on the X-Men, a more intimate take, and a take that I, you know, like a Claremont run that I want to last, like, you know, let me read 200 issues of this. Let me read a big, long, giant run of this. So I hope whenever, and that's not to say that the Hickman stuff isn't interesting too, but in a different way, it kind of is the other end of the spectrum. What if, let's tell a story where the whole universe is X-Men and X-Men related. And, you know, you've got X-Men, you've got mutant cities and mutant civilization and mutant society, kind of similar to what we're getting in the Age of X-Men, but that taking it to an extreme with fascism being a big theme. But this, it reminds me so much of the classic Claremont, John Byrne run, where you're talking about small stories and it's so much of the story, so much of the entertainment value, so much of why it's compelling has to do with the relationships and the interactions of the characters, especially when you're putting them in really difficult positions and putting them in situations where they have to make tough choices. And our viewpoint, our window, our relatability, our accessibility into each of the individual characters, the way we see inside of them is through, and the way we learn to know about them and who they are, it's through their reaction to the situation they're being put in. You know, they're all in this tough spot, and Havoc is talking about being embarrassed he can't walk through the front door. Cyclops is more focused on leaving a lasting legacy, leaving a legacy of good. And, you know, different characters fall different places on that spectrum. And that's how we know who they are. How are they reacting to the situation they've been put in? How are they dealing with it? What do they see as important? How much do they care about their friends?
How do they react when they go up against an enemy? You know, Jaime Madrox was ready to kill the Dark Beast. So, so much of what's happening is dependent on their point of view from that perspective. And I think that is the strength of this run that Matthew Rosenberg is giving us in Uncanny X-Men. So, absolutely fantastic issue. As great and as nostalgic as it is, you think, well, it can't really get any better, because it's so, it has such a classic X-Men feel. But the thing that makes it even better is the LaRocca art. The LaRocca art is just absolutely fantastic. It elevates it. It's beautiful line work, his action scenes, the classic X-Men costumes. It is so good. Salvador LaRocca, I mean, I know he gets a lot of credit and got a lot of credit for what a great job he did on Darth Vader. And that's such a different feeling book because it's Star Wars and it should feel epic and cinematic and science fiction. And here it's, you know, it's much more superheroic. But what I love about LaRocca and where his talent lies is the fact that here he is doing a traditional superhero story, a traditional superhero comic in the X-Men. But the way he lays out people within the panels, the way he does his storytelling, it's also focusing on the same thing that Rosenberg's storytelling is focusing on. And that is the interaction between the characters. It's how they're dealing with the situation. I mean, just the conversation between Cyclops and Wolverine when they're talking about before how Cyclops was saying, yeah, the guy with knives for hands wants to kill everybody. That's his solution. And Wolverine's saying, yeah, and the guy with rose-colored glasses thinks that, you know, saving the world's a solution, that kind of thing. That interplay between the two is done so expertly in the illustrations that you all, I mean, it's great that we have the dialogue and the jokes, but even if you didn't have that, you would still understand the gist of what's going on between the two of them, how they're kind of at odds. And then we get the little smile from Cyclops that lightens the mood. And then we see that they've come together. They've kind of come to an understanding and agreement. And that is all seen there in the page just by looking at the art, without looking at the dialogue. So, you know, you can't ask for any more than that. That is the definition of sequential storytelling with art. And between that and the just how cool everybody looks in their costume, what a great job he does drawing Dark Beast and how menacing he makes him look. And then you've got Expert Colors by Guru FX. I mean, it's just a beautiful comic. It's very much deserving of the title X-Men, you know, Uncanny X-Men. I mean, that is a classic comic book title that always deserves to be of really high quality with great creators on it. And the creative team here hasn't let it down at all. If you have not read the Uncanny X-Men Disassembled storyline, it's pretty interesting. I think reading that involves a pretty big commitment because you've got to be willing to you got to be willing to basically read not only that, but also the Age of X-Men event to understand that. But I think you could pick up Matthew Rosenberg's run on X-Men without having read X-Men Disassembled. You could just pick up Uncanny X-Men 11 and just read this and be able to pick up through context what's happened and then just enjoy this for what it is, which is classic X-Men stories that feel authentic with amazing art. So really, really loving what Matthew Rosenberg is doing. And I know he's a huge X-Men fan. I'm going to have to have him on the show one of these days to talk X-Men for sure. So anyway, that's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank everybody for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.